Make a start. Chris is going to lead off on what will our alternative to capitalism look like?
Yeah, I won't ramble on, but I thought it would be good to think about some of the questions that face us as people who are trying to criticise the existing order. A lot of us are quite comfortable with the label anti-capitalist, a lot quite comfortable with the idea of the fact that we have a radical alternative to the current society. But actually articulating what that would be raises a number of problems, issues to be addressed. The first and most obvious one is whether we should be doing that in the first place. There's a strong tradition of libertarian thought, both in Marxism and anarchism, that almost resists the idea that you should be putting blueprints of an alternative society, that this is something that's articulated, figured out through struggle, through working class struggle, social struggles. So that's one issue that has to be addressed immediately. So to what extent you can define this alternative society that we're striving for. The other issue, I guess, if you move beyond that, because throughout the anarchist and Marxist tradition, whether they like it or not, we do articulate some sort of alternative, whether it's looking at our own history, or many people use fiction to kind of sketch examples of how a communist society, a socialist society would work. Many of us look concretely to the here and now, in the way that as working class militants, as anarchists, we may treat each other, to what extent that figures into our kind of future vision. So leading on from those kind of ideas, the kind of immediate ones is sort of, if a communist society exists, then you're saying something very basic about the way that things are ordered and functions. Like a capitalist society works on the basis that there is a boss who owns a factory, the means of production, to use Marxist economics, who you then go work for. He gives you a wage. He takes money away from you in terms of surplus value, makes lots of profit and buys more things, and you're exploited in the process. Now, the basis of communist society is that the profit system won't work, that labour is essentially free and voluntary. The Marxist, or Marx's original quote of from each according to his abilities to each according to his needs. So everyone is free to work as much as they are able, and they receive from the community enough to satisfy them both materially and also intellectually and creatively. but the big gap that exists, I mean, most of us can agree on that, that on a basic level, economically, that's how a communist society works. The big gap is how is that administered? I mean, it's kind of, these are kind of hard words to use, because immediately when you think administered, you think, I don't know, council, politics, governments. But on some level, every type of society has an element of social coordination. There's order to any kind of society, even a completely chaotic one. There's some sense of order. So what are the things that are going to bring about this sense of order? Is it going to be, on a very basic level, people's relationships to each other? Are we talking about organisations? Are we talking about something approximating a state, something close to a state, as the Leninists would argue? How is this kind of figured out? So, I mean, those are kind of the questions that immediately come to mind. And to kind of bring in the recommended reading that we looked at for this session, I think they kind of add a bit more detail to this debate, in the sense that Marx's writings on the Paris Commune represent communist writing on perhaps the first working class experiment in communal living, and they're important in this respect. And almost all socialist thought from that point looks at some point to the Commune as an example of how a working class society would work. And Marx has his critiques of it. Kropotkin writes on it, Bakunin writes on it also. They all have varying ideas about why it went wrong, why the working class were unable to retain power, about the administration. So that's one thing that people look at. Yeah, and then you have Marx's critique of the Gotha program. I hope I'm pronouncing that right.
I was getting wrong as well.
Yeah. Where he's looking actually at kind of the way that a working class organisation addresses issues in the here and now, but ideas of whether cooperatives could figure into a communist society, to how they are managed, how economic relationships are managed in that society, and where you should stand right now in terms of those economic bodies. And then finally you have Kalinikos with his writings. And,
it's not Kalinikos, is it?
Sorry, no, Castoriadis. I always get this confused. Sorry. They have Castoriadis, where he gives an incredibly detailed sketch of what a socialist society, calls it a socialist society, but it's economically, it's communist. What a socialist society would be like, and this is incredibly detailed and incredibly thorough. I won't go into kind of ins and outs of it. So, I mean, they're the kind of three different kind of ideas of approaching the subject, which other kind of thinkers have done. So, to kind of start the discussion, it might be useful kind of addressing to those kind of three questions that I pose. One is whether we should be thinking about alternatives in that concrete sense, whether it's possible to have a blueprint. The second one is the idea of, like, we can all pretty much agree how a communist society would run, but how is it ordered? That's probably a good way of putting it. And the third question is looking at the kind of the history of the working class movement. Is it possible to look back at kind of the commune or the way that working class organisations did things, and figure that into our ideas about the future?
Okay, thanks for that. Responses?
I don't really have any answers to those. Well, some will have an answer to the third question about the usefulness of historical examples, which are just that on quite practical level, the forms of the future may or may not resemble, like, the Petrograd Soviet or the Iranian Shores or the Paris Commune or whatever, but, like, it, or Black the Ukraine or whatever example you want to give, but... it is very useful to have these historical examples just when talking to people. It's a lot more practical to say, here are ideas that worked on a certain scale for a certain time period, than just say, everything will be loads better in the future. I have no proof for this, but trust me. And the other thing I wanted to raise was a fourth question, because I didn't read the Castoriadis or have that, but I did read quite a bit of the William Morris, which one notable thing that came out of that was that... Morris is kind of like very anti-technology and keen on medieval society, which is possibly like more of a peculiar quirk of his than something that's that relevant to the communist movement. But especially sort of in the situation we are now at the start of the 21st century rather than the middle or end of the 19th, it is kind of like very it's sort of impossible to avoid thinking about technology and resource shortages and what that's going to mean, because communism isn't going to mean that there's, like, unlimited oil or the resources aren't going to run out. So I just kind of wondered what people think about, like, what the level of technology in future society would be like. Like, does communism mean that everyone can have an iPhone, or does it mean we have to, like, radically rethink those kind of priorities? Personally, I'm in favour of everyone having iPhones, but I don't know how possible it is.
Anybody else?
Well, I mean, I could probably go on at length about that. I think what you touched on there about resource shortages is crucial, really. I think many of the... Well, I think essentially that the kind of communist and socialist movements are essentially kind of byproducts of industrial society and are... And most of the... Marxist thinkers haven't actually been able to kind of mentally escape from industrial society, really. And now we appear to be near the beginning of the end of industrial civilization in terms of energy shortages, resource shortages, the fact that we're, you know, essentially humanity as a whole is essentially committing ecocide, and we're destroying the planet to such an extent that, you know, we're going to render it, the way things are going, we're going to render it uninhabitable for large variety of species. Since 19, you know, according to the Zoological Society of London, since 1970, between a quarter and a third of all species on the planet have been made extinct, and this was a survey they did about 2 or 3 years ago. We're in the middle of the planet's sixth mass extinction. You know, this isn't like the end of an ice age and the beginning of a warm period. This is, you know, which has happened many, many times before without there being mass extinctions. This is like, you know, the one that wiped out the dinosaurs was caused by a meteorite. It's not clear what caused the other four, but maybe it was climate change. We're now kind of climate change situation, resource depletion, that, you know, well, just general kind of poisoning of the oceans, poisoning of the air, destruction of topsoil, destruction of the forests. You know, we're on the brink of a lot of tipping points, and a lot of the ideas of socialism and communism were based on the idea of there being, you know, abundance, material wealth. And yeah, clearly that isn't going to be the case. So I mean, I think Morris is very interesting. I haven't actually read any of the other texts, and it was a long time ago that I read News from Nowhere. But I think Morris is kind of interesting in that way. So I don't think capitalism. I mean, it'd be great if capitalism was our only problem, but I don't think it is our only problem. But I mean, to be more positive, I think it appears that there might be kind of germ forms of post-capitalist production occurring within capitalism now. I think the free software movement, which is basically, it's been in many ways kind of adopted and taken over by capital, but it still hasn't. It's still kind of, the essence is still there. It's basically a kind of free association of producers and consumers, where basically just people are doing what they want because they like doing it. That's how it all started, and they are producing kind of software that's competing with the biggest capitalist corporations on the planet. And I think it's the kind of the economic and the manner in which the production of free software has been organised is, for me, the kind of one of the most inspiring models of how post-capitalist economic production might work. And it's basically where just people, just everyone just does what they want. And I think that's my model, really. Everyone should just do what they want. Anyway, I could go on, but I'll stop there.
Okay. David?
No, go ahead. yeah, I mean, I think a question there, a question that comes out in the text, is the idea of transition. Because, in a sense, obviously, in a way, the future communist society will reflect how we get there. So the means of struggle, the means of social change are invariably reflected in the end you get. And often it's said on the Leninist or Trotskyist left that you have a sort of mid-stage, which is called either socialism or a workers' state, which assumes the existence of the state, obviously, but also, for example, money or wage labour. And even the Castoriadis has some of that. Yeah, I think it presumes wages exist, and it presumes the state exists. You know, he sort of said, oh, it withers away. It reflects some of his baggage from Trotskyism, I suppose. But an interesting thing is, often it's said, oh, well, this is something totally different to the capitalist state. It's a workers' state. But Castoriadis constantly refers to it as the remnants of the state, implying it's a bit of the same thing left over rather than something radically different. I think one, in terms of communism, it's not just, often you hear slogans like it'll be a society where money's put into public services rather than war, or, you know, that kind of quite pat slogan. But it comes out strongly in the critique of the Gotha Programme that it's not just sort of redistributing wealth or equality of incomes or anything like that. It's challenging the division of labour and the division of control that exists in capitalist society.
You know, so in that sense, there's no special organisations other than, you know, there's no kind of cast of politicians who govern in a left-wing way, but rather that society consumes the functions currently operated by the state. I think actually the only way to bring communism about would be for the changes to be immediate, and the transitional society possible, since if you maintain division of control or management hierarchies, then they have a sort of dynamic of their own. I think it is worthwhile to look to historic examples, not necessarily to say that, oh well, we want to live like they did in Paris in 1871, because actually, you know, in the Paris Commune they were, you know, eating dogs and rats and stuff. It wasn't actually particularly great that, you know, it was in the middle of a war and so on. But you know, if, like, say the Russian Revolution, you have this idea, oh, we'll suspend control of the Soviets for a bit and then we're going to row back later. But actually, as soon as they do that, obviously, you know, the party and the nomenclature and so on take power for themselves. I think in that sense, a communist revolution would be sort of immediately get rid of money, immediately get rid of the state and so on.
Do you mind if I come in and then? Do you want to come in?
Yeah, sure.
Do you want to come in?
It's
alright. Okay.
I'll put myself at the end of that.
Oh, okay.
I'll
pass
it on to you.
No, you go on. Should we have a facilitator?
I'll just come in here anyway. Okay. This point about blueprints. Lots of people don't like capitalism, they don't fully agree with it, but at the bottom of when you speak to people about an alternative, they don't really believe that there is an alternative. And you know, they look at, say, the history of the Russian Revolution, and they look at Stalinism, they look at the dictatorship of the party over the workers, say, with Lenin, and the way that developed. So they think any attempt at an alternative is going to end in some kind of dictatorship over the workers. So if the workers try to free themselves, it's going to end in even worse conditions than Western capitalism, for example. So, you know, because of that, I think it is important that you do have a vision of an alternative society, or at least think about what it would look like, because you've got to persuade people. Like, we consider ourselves to be communist. Now, of course, communism, the word communism is tainted, like the word socialism is tainted. You know, there's a history there. The Labour Party, for example, socialism. Communism, Stalinism is associated with. So right away, when we say we're communist, we have to explain what we mean by communism. So you're compelled to actually put forward an alternative communist vision, if you like, or at least indicate what it would be like. So you're struggling against exploitation. You've got to explain what a non-exploitative society would look like. Now, on this point about blueprints, well, you know, a lot of Marx's objection to blueprints is because they were precisely that. They were very detailed. Like, it's Fourier and others. They often have very detailed blueprints. So the size of the workers' canteen, the communal canteen, you know, the number of people who would sit together, what the menu would be, you know, what they should do with the land and so on. Now, we're absolutely against that kind of order, to use your word, or blueprint. We're against that. I mean, what somebody mentioned, William Morris. A lot of, as you say, we need to think about that point about abundance given modern society, whether that might be too optimistic. But what comes across in Morris is that, whereas a lot of Trotskyists and Leninists talk about, that the transition is quite simple. I mean, for Lenin, for example, it was capitalism plus the Bolsheviks. You know, it was like a German war communism plus the Bolsheviks. That was his alternative. So it's like, you know, the post office with Lenin in charge. So in other words, there's organisations already in capitalism. Capitalism is the basis for the alternative society, which, you know, I don't think, we can't agree with that. So the one thing, when you read Morris, he's talking about workers being liberated. There is no state. There's a federation of communes. People decide amongst themselves what they want to produce. and they decide how they're going to produce. You know, and so some people, they're associated workers that they cooperate, and the communities are small enough to have bonds of friendship, so that, you know, you can do one job for a period and then you change with somebody else and do another job and so on. So although he puts his own slant on it as an artist, and really people have to put their own slant on things, it is about people collectively choosing how they want to live and how they want to produce. Might well be what you might want to abolish some industries altogether, you know. But I mean, in terms of the Paris, like, commune, I mean, Marx's point about the commune is, I mean, the commune itself, it wasn't a modern working class. It was just small-scale producers. So it wasn't a modern working class, but they were workers, and they dispensed with the state. That's the main thing. You didn't have a standing army. You had militia. You know, you didn't have paid officials. So all that waste, all that money going to judges, officials, administrators, and all the rest of it, is gone. So you make huge savings for a start. Nobody gets more than the it's all about equality as well, I think, that nobody gets more than the average worker. So if you do find yourself being a representative, one, you're recallable. You're just a delegate in that sense, and you don't get any privileges. And that's the main thing. So the whole point about the commune was that it was the self-emancipation of the working class, that the masses consciously are deciding how to run their lives. I think that was the main point for Marx, that state power is dissolved and society takes over, so to speak. The associated producers take over. Now, just to end on the history of the movement, I think, you know, the point's been made, it's quite correct, that you can talk about how we'd like to see things without wage labour, and I think wage slavery, and that's one of the first steps that Marx said, you have to abolish wages, you have to abolish money. You just produce and you have like a credit card on a communal store, so to speak. So that's the very first step, which, you know, a lot of people seem to forget about. But I think, as the comrade said, you do need to point, like, to 1917, for example, where you had mass workers' creativity, where in the workers' councils of the Soviets, they were deciding things. This is before the party took over and it became a dictatorship over the workers. The Hungarian councils in 1956, and I think you mentioned some more as well. So it is important to point to history to see where, you know, the masses have acted autonomously, they have been creative, and they have done things to demolish capitalism. You know, it's not succeeded, but that doesn't mean to say, you know, we can't succeed. Sorry, did you want to go next?
No, your hand is up first.
Okay.
Sure, you're on the same.
Yeah.
I just wanted to kind of go back briefly to this kind of what Chris was saying about the kind of being tied to industrialization, these kind of socialist Marxist ideas. I think there is an element of truth in that. I think there are strains of Marxist theory, and you can see it a little bit in anarchism, but not so much, that kind of argues that capitalism needs to kind of reach a certain point before communism is possible, in the sense that capitalism almost provides the society, the material need, you know, building blocks, and then communism is just about administration. And I think you're right, we've reached a point now where a certain model of industrialization has clearly failed, and is threatening our very existence on this planet. So I think in terms of a social ecology and environmentalism has to be absolutely ingrained into any vision of the future. But I'm kind of also really resistant to kind of the ideas that are proposed by Mike Morris and others in the environment, the current environmental movement, that kind of talks about scarcity, essentially, that we need to kind of do without in order to we need to share and do without. And I think communism has had too much of that, if anything. Like, the you know, what people called communism in the Eastern Bloc in Stalinist Russia was characterized by that, by the fact that you couldn't have what you needed, by food shortages, by shortages in basic commodities. And if anything, if we're going to demonstrate a communist society is going to work, we need to say that actually you'll have more than you want. But I think the key to that is perhaps I'm perhaps optimistic about the amount that capitalism is actually incredibly wasteful as a system. And I think if you, there are ways of perhaps producing things and administrating the economy in a way that is not as wasteful as capitalism does, but still provides people with adequate, sustenance, access to Xboxes and iPhones, whatever they want. And just as to finish off kind of as a more general point, I think there is a general kind of problem with this idea of, I agree that you need examples of what a communist society would be, but there is a general problem in that even now, if you were to ask someone, what is a capitalist society? I mean, years and years of economic study and economic theory and history hasn't done that adequately. It's so complex, because human society is complex. So I think it's very difficult to do. And I think a communist society will be incredibly complex, and will, be hard to explain. But that's not necessarily a bad thing.
Can I respond?
Yeah.
Just in that, I think that what you were talking about with the, particularly with the kind of freeware movement as it's kind of currently characterised, is quite an important part of what you're talking about, which is that I think it is possible for elements of something kind of beyond capitalism to grow in a society. And in fact, I don't think it's just possible. I think it's completely necessary, and I think it has to happen. I think the idea that we can draw up a plan of what things are going to look like afterwards is misguided and going to go terribly, terribly wrong. But what I do think can happen is that we can create kind of elements like the freeware movement, and kind of some of the environmental sort of movements that are going on, although I do think that they are very kind of vulnerable to being commodified and being kind of turned into a set of sort of sexy lifestyle choices for affluent middle class university graduates. And I'm sure I'm guilty of that myself. But I think that it's that you can kind of, that it would be helpful to think of kind of ways that you can use the model of kind of quite small scale micro models of something like freeware and kind of apply that to other forms of production and providing things that people need. And I think that there's something really key about what you were talking about, which is that freeware is something which everybody needs. Everybody uses computers. Everybody, it's something which is quite accessible to almost everybody. And I think that's a key difference between that and things like, solar panels or compost toilets or, the things that are on grand designs on TV. It's that those are only really available and only really necessary for a small portion of society. So I think that it might be helpful to look at ways of providing another model to give something quite small but quite useful and quite helpful to everybody, and I think perhaps indie media is another, the internet is a huge part of that, the ability to access kind of news and texts as well, even books. It would be great if you could get that on the internet for free without being attached to a university or something like that, online libraries and that kind of thing. I think those are helpful ways of thinking about what will become in the future.
Yeah. First of all, apologies, I haven't done any of the reading for this, but I'm going to throw that into the ring anyway. I think maybe first to kind of, I guess basically I'm kind of describing the discussion in a sense, but I hope we're moving to something else. But I think libertarian lefts quite often, we think more about the means and what we're doing, which is, and how is that going to influence the eventual communist or whatever, socialist, we want to frame it, society that we're looking at working towards, from my experience. And often we define our, often libertarian left can define its politics, I think, by its tactics, if you know what I mean, by the means you want to bring about that and the strategies we have to bring about this end, and don't talk about the end so much. And whether that's a good or a bad thing, I don't have an opinion on, but I think if we're kind of serious about the communist idea and the communist project, we have to expect that there's going to be other very able and good minds brought into the movement who will have other answers to these questions we're talking about, of resources and the ecology movement and freedom of media and ownership rights, these things. And there'll be even better answers brought into the ring as we progress towards that. So the whole thing can be, I guess, considered a transition of sorts. But I guess it's good to talk about, I think when speaking to people about communism and what it might look like or anything like that, it is good to talk, to point to history, but often that can feel quite abstract from where we are sitting right now in a post-industrial society, if you like, however you'd like to frame it. I'm not, but talking about things right now is really good at saying, like, well, this is the kind of thing we're talking about. We can say, like, or you know, imagine if you're a research working in university and you didn't have the problem of having to get funds in order to justify what research you're doing, how would that change? So we can look at the kind of things we have a problem with in current society and how things would change about that. But I've often defined what I'm standing for, what I'm interested in by, I guess, the fairly similar to basic ideals of what led to, I guess, like the French Revolution, so those really basic ideas of liberty, equality and justice, and defining things in that way and seeing whether those things haven't happened in society. And clearly the French Revolution was a failure on that respect. But I think with ecology as well, and with saying, like, proposing these alternatives, I see what you're saying, but I think again there's a transition in that as well, because you're offering, you've got to think what people who aren't dedicated communists that might be interested in very broad ideals of where we're going in society, and there's going to be a transition in that. People are still probably going to want to use the sewer systems and use other things that are wasteful and damaging to the environment. So I guess often, in a sense, what we're talking about is the transition and is the means. I mean, and I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing.
Anybody else?
Money cannot be abolished by dictate or from above. Money will continue to exist and be used as long as it's useful. So money is only going to cease to really exist, I think, when it ceases to become useful. And that is when, you know, people can get it exchange in terms of goods and services, you know, is predominantly done without money, and there ceases to be any use for money. I think the idea that it can be kind of abolished in one stroke from above appears to me to indicate that there will be some hierarchical organisation making that decision, and that's not how I. That's kind of. I think hierarchy is probably our biggest problem. I think it was. I mean, obviously, things, imperialism, empire predates capitalism. It appears that imperial civilizations have existed for maybe 10,000 years. And they've been built on the basis of agriculture, and agriculture allowed, you know, a small number of people to exist off the surpluses generated by a large number of people, and it was the kind of devastation of the area that's now Iraq, where some of the first civilizations grew up, and, you know, all the places where the first civilizations grew up are now deserts and And that's what's continuing, the way things are going. The Amazon's going to burn to the ground in our lifetimes. It's not going to exist anymore. I'm not a big fan of Derek Jensen. I've got a lot of problems with him, but there's one little catchphrase of his that stuck in my mind, which is forests preceded us, deserts bite at our heels. And it's, you know, that's his kind of summation of human civilization. And so I think hierarchy and empire, and I think there's big problems with agriculture, because agriculture in terms of destruction of biodiversity and topsoil, and you know, I think all of these things need to be revisited and reconsidered. In terms of the kind of what does the free software movement, how does that translate into other areas? I mean, the way I'd envisage it translating, it would basically mean the design of everything would be free and freely available and freely amendable. And I mean, the most interesting kind of cutting edge moving kind of free software stuff into other areas, I think, that's happening are the Fab Labs, where people are basically creating small scale manufacturing places where things can be made on any scale, using basically making machines that can make machines that are based on free designs. And so you're basically just starting to create somewhere where people can go and make anything they want, using kind of recycled plastic and recycled steel, and using free designs. And I think it's the design of everything becoming free and freely available and freely amendable and freely improvable. That's the only way we're going to get things produced that aren't disposable. I don't know if people have seen the story of Stuff, but that's a kind of very good short little animation. That's got one, again, figure that's stuck in my mind. 90% of all goods sold in the United States end up in the dustbin within 6 months. So basically, everything that we're being, virtually everything that's being produced at the moment is just being, you know, if we're lucky, landfilled. If we're not lucky, burnt, then landfilled. And or even worse, being shipped in containers over to China and India, where kids, you know, poison themselves, pulling apart all the things. And everything that's produced, you know, like this recorder recording this, it's been designed and produced in a way with no thought for how those metals and those plastics can be disassembled and made into something else, and no thought about how it can be repaired, how it can last. And I think it's kind of, if there were open, free designs that were available to anyone, i.e., you know, amendable by anyone, then you could actually start to see the design of stuff that was able to be reused and could last and could be repaired, because nothing's repairable at the moment. And so it's all just, we're just trashing, you know, all the available resources as quickly as possible. That's what industrial civilization is doing at the moment.
And also to add on to that, things are not only designed inconsiderately, but designed in a way so they actively stop the integration of different forms of technology because of, you know, the idea of private property. And I think, like, that has to be, in terms of, like, I think it's really important what you're saying about the idea of money, that the money needs to be irrelevant. And I think, yeah, one of the kind of fundamental things that needs to be done is to look at how we make things now and whether it's a necessary thing to do. And I think when you look at it, you know, a huge amount of the economy right now is either replicating things that are produced in different ways, or producing things so they can't be reused, or producing things so you have to buy several. You know, it's designed on waste. It's premised on waste. And I think and to kind of move that into kind of the struggles that exist around that. I mean, I think what's quite inspiring is often when you have workers who are in manufacturing or you know, at the kind of very base end, you know, they're very aware that a lot of their products are not very useful. You know, and I think it was around a lot of the recent struggles that Vestas, where a lot of the workers were talking about, you know, after, you know, if the struggle could be won and they could take over the factory, you know, what could be done to a car parts factory that could be socially useful? And that's, you know, that this is kind of in, you know, it would have been 2009 Britain, you know, and if they're having that discussion at the kind of state we're in now, I mean, as the kind of struggle advances, like, those questions can get deeper and more, you know, penetrating, and we can really start to question some of the kind of fundamental things that exist in our society, right?
Yeah, I was just thinking to come back a bit on the discussion over whether we can see communism or rankism as something that's kind of like present in existing society to some extent, or at least a tendency towards it. As with the free software movement, I think that rather than just saying that it's going to be like Russia in 1917 or Spain in 1936 or Hungary in 1956, it can be sort of like more fruitful to look at as a tendency sort of towards mutual aid and solidarity, which obviously is very much not the defining feature of present-day society, but is something that's kind of like ever-present continuously from the first sort of shaky little primitive communist hunter-gatherer societies where they had everything in common because they didn't really have anything worth holding. Up till today, those features have always been present on some level because obviously you don't want to idealise the family because it's a very sort of hierarchical and flawed institution, but the way that goods are distributed in that is very much on the principle of people get things in accordance to what they need and rather than in accordance to what they can afford within that unit. And the way people act on an everyday basis towards their friends, they don't act towards them in a capitalist manner of I'll provide you with this good or this service if doing so will increase my material wealth, because if people acted like that, then they wouldn't have any friends quite quickly. People do kind of behave in these ways in everyday life, and obviously we don't want to sort of like idealise this and kind of overlook the ways in which people do fuck each other over massively on an everyday basis, but I think drawing these things out was a tendency that always exists and can become the main feature of the society, possibly can be a fruitful way to look at it.
Yeah, David.
I think on the question of money, that I didn't mean to imply in what I said before that you have like some like revolutionary government which like passes a bill in Parliament saying right, no more money. So, you know, obviously to the extent that people recognise it as something which has more value, that they would continue to do so, but. I mean, money. So I wasn't sort of suggesting that, but I mean, in certain sort of revolutionary experiences, I mean, people have literally just stopped using money. A big bang revolution where people just sort of take over their workplaces and start trading stuff with each other for free. I don't think that we could create a communist society. So I'm not saying anyone's saying this, but I don't think we could create a communist society sort of on the margins of capitalist society, like we just all start kind of living out the society we want, kind of like if we go and live off in a commune or something like that. Because I would want us to steal from the capitalists what they have, and you know the vast majority of people in the world, you know, have very little access to land and water and that kind of thing. So in that sense. I think the revolution would be a sort of big bang, kind of fairly quick transfer of power rather than us sort of gradually building our society within the existing one. But I would agree that there are possibilities for, like, so as you mentioned, with free software, but there are also things like, as people know, like in Argentina and there's a couple in Bolivia as well, you know, workplaces which during the last set of crises, workers just stole and started running them themselves. So I think, I think probably those can't kind of last forever within capitalism. They're still subject to the market, like they still use money. and obviously money is in itself a source of alienation, because it, people recognise that there's this like power above them with its own special attributes which they have to, you know, worship, as it were, you know. So it's people don't see themselves just like making stuff for the sake of it, or because people need it, but rather for the sake of accumulating money. So I think in like on the discussion of kind of past examples, like I guess I'd be much more likely to say to someone that, you know, those workplaces in Argentina are taken over by workers like, you know, Zanon. I'd be more likely to say to someone that that is an example that communism could work than talk about, you know, Russia in 1917 or something, because it's a bit, I think, I mean, there's Naomi Klein film about it, and, you know, I don't think she's the best, but, you know, it's a fairly decent to show people that, because obviously that society is in a way quite like our own. You know, it's not all, you know, peasants and stuff. It's just a very big and very expensive factory where they make something, you know, tiles. It's fairly mundane, but so in a sense prefigures the sort of relations we'd want.
Hmm. Any other comments? And I just wanted to make a point about the about capitalism has to be developed up to a certain point, as if everything rests just on technological advance, as if it's just a matter of development of the productive forces. I don't think that is a communist view. The communist view is based on humanity. It's based on the creative power of human beings. So it's not really about the mainspring of progress being technology. I mean, if you look at, for example, Marx, when he discussed the mir, which was, you know, an element of Tsarist society, an element of Russian society, where you had remnants of the peasant commune or the peasant community. So it was non-capitalist relationships. And Marx thought that, you know, you could get to communism through that. Not through, you know, advanced technology, but through that. That you had the basis for communism there in those non-capitalist relationships. Now, you know, important Marxists like Russian Marxist, like Plekhanov, actually, you know, hid that that analysis. I think Marx wrote to them, and they deliberately lost the letter, you know, but because they had their own views, which were seriously at odds with Marx, and is that an entire tradition of Russian communism, which is at odds with Marx, really, when you read Marx as well, but. Yeah, this point about, I don't think anybody's suggesting that there's a parliamentary decree. I mean, the whole point, there won't be any parliament. The workers will be managers themselves. They'll have a militia, so they'll have guns. They'll have their own representatives who they control. So if you've got money, then you've got alienation. If you've got money, then you've got wage labour. If you've got money, you've got capital. Now, the whole point about fighting against capital is that if you have a commune, and a federation of communes, then money is irrelevant, because there won't be any wage labour. You won't be working for a wage for a boss or an owner of a capitalist enterprise or a state bureaucracy or state capitalist class. So, you know, I don't accept, you know, that we can't get rid of money and wage labour, because if you think they're natural or permanent features and not subject to historical change, then, you know, you're back to capitalism. You know, you won't be able to get beyond capitalism, I don't think.
No, I'm all in favour of getting rid of money as soon as possible.
Yeah,
sorry,
yes.
If I was misunderstood.
Yeah.
The point I was trying to make was that I think money will cease to exist when it ceases to have any use.
Yeah.
I think that's the
sure,
point
yeah.
when it will go.
Yeah.
And that won't necessarily come from above, that will
no.
kind of come from below.
No, absolutely, really, yeah. Yeah.
Sorry. Oh, it's just a quick point, because I don't want to get bogged into a discussion of Marxism, but
no.
I wouldn't be so easy on Marx. I think he is, although he is a very important figure, and very influential and very useful. He's also, like all human beings, a flawed one. And I think there is contradictions in his thought, and he is tied in to a certain extent to this kind of enlightenment idea of progress. And you can see it, like he writes very uncritically about colonization, for example, in certain pieces of his work. Some of his analysis of certain nation states being better than others because they centralize. You know, I think that you have to acknowledge it, but
there are no gods.
Yeah, but I think it's true to say that he expressed some very sincere communist ideas as well, exactly the ones that you were saying about, the communes in Russia.
I think the point that you made about progress is a really interesting one, because what I was going to ask was if and what would be you understand how progress is the kind of dominant myth of the, particularly the 19th but also the 20th century, I think, and I would be interested to know how you could see how anyone around this table could imagine subverting that myth so that it's useful. Because I think that any society is going to have its gods and its demons. I think fortunately or unfortunately, I think that's kind of part of the way that human beings work, and I think the progress has been one of, I mean, I appreciate that that's probably contentious, but I think that's been one of the kind of dominant things of the last 200 years or so, and 300, and I'd be interested to see if we can think of an alternative to progress which isn't material accumulation or the kind of speeding up of everything. And I think that's quite a kind of notable feature of society as it's lived today, just in terms of all the inventions that we make. You know, they don't do new things, they do the same thing faster. And I wonder if there's some other way of thinking about progress, and if anyone can think of it, because I can't.
Just coming through a couple of points, but one of them's on the whole idea of progress and this kind of like idea of communism as being like the end point of this inevitable process of the technology getting better and stuff, and without wanting to sound like too much of a rabid Walter Benjamin fanboy, which I slightly am, I think this is one of the things that his theory of history is really good on, because rather than progress is being this building up of productive capacities, until it reaches the point where you can have communism, he sort of sees historical progress as being this continuous process of exploitation and greater and continuous defeat for whatever the ruling class happens to be over the working class happens to be. So in one essay he kind of uses the metaphor of progress as being the sort of spark as being this fuse that has to be cut before the spark reaches the dynamite, which I think again dovetails very neatly with the critique of progress that's been coming out of the environmental movement. And rather than seeing progress as something that's going to save us, it can be seen as something that's got to be stopped and derailed. And I think the idea of having a sort of anti-progress critique, I think, is something that's really very possible in the 21st century, because sort of all the existing myths of progress have been completely shattered. You had the kind of like Leninist, Stalinist one of the inevitable victory of the workers' revolution spreading the model of the Soviet Union, and that's obviously been completely wrong. Don't think there's any dispute about that. And then there was like the social democratic myth of progress, where you won popularity for the ideas of the existing socialist party until they got into power, which has now happened, but none of them have any socialist ideas left whatsoever. And finally, perhaps most powerfully, there's the myth of liberal progress, which for a very brief period in the early 90s thought that was dominant after the fall of the Soviet Union, when you had the end of history and all that bollocks, which again, has now been very clearly dismantled because it can't stop the process of boom and bust, and it can't stop increasing global conflict, and you've got the sort of horrible medieval ideology of Islam, which in any kind of... Oh, no, fundamentalist Islamism, rather... I wasn't just writing it with on bus there, but in any view of the world that takes historical progress as something for granted, that you really can't explain why these kind of incredibly reactionary ideas, looking back to kind of historical caliphates and things, should have such a wide appeal. And I think the only way to answer that question is to say that simple historical progress doesn't look like that. It's a process of, you know, dialectics and class struggle and all those other things that communists like.
Anybody else?
Mine's quite quick, if that's okay. Yeah, you can.
Yeah, no, go ahead.
There's a kind of contradiction that in this, in the sense that, like, I think there is like clear an element of technological process that occurs over time that is observable. Like we didn't have computers in, you know, the 18th century. Like you can observe that. Also, a lot of anarchists and radical thinkers say the Enlightenment is sort of a good thing as well, in the sense that it encourages people to be critical of our existing society, and it takes, you know, the state to task and what it promises to do, which is also an element of progress. But just to say that Kropotkin kind of says it as well, like earlier on, that like progress is only that which increases individual creativity, capacity, and cooperation. Which means if you view it in that sense, and you judge all societies like this, progress actually goes backwards and forwards. So you might have very early societies that are incredibly progressive, but then, you know, capitalism comes along and destroys them, and then you might have periods where it's progressive again, and, you know, it's more of a zigzag, I suppose, than a straight line, which I think might be a better way of looking at it. Don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think the progress stuff's very interesting. I mean, maybe another way of looking at it is looking at some of the things that have happened in history and maybe considering whether, you know, the cost was worth the gains, and you know, was the accumulation of material wealth that came about through slavery, was that worth it? Was the destruction of, you know, millions of lives, African lives, worth it? Was the genocide in the Americas, where, you know, perhaps 90% of the indigenous population in the Americas were wiped out as a result of European colonization. And I mean, from my point of view, it wasn't worth it at all. And I don't have any answers about, you know, an alternative way of describing stuff that makes, you know, things sound great. But I agree. And nowadays, the kind of progress is actually just accumulation of stuff, isn't it? It's material goods. That's how you're meant to measure success. It's, you know, how much junk you've got, you know, how many electronic gadgets you've got, how many cars you've got, etc., etc. It's probably a complete tangent, and we don't want to get into it. But the whole kind of clash of civilizations, war and terror stuff. I think the fear of, you know, fundamentalist Islam. I mean, I think it's basically empire has created. They had a need to create a new enemy, and they went out and created a new enemy in order to justify a new round of imperial resource wars, and that's what happened there. And I think it's extremely tragic that large sections of the left have actually been duped by this and have kind of go along with it, and, you know, and that's a really big mistake, I think.
Yeah, I mean, you know, quite clearly there has been historical change. I mean, you know, a peasant in the Middle Ages would be a different kind of person than we are in this room. you know, human nature is malleable. So, you know, you can't have change without being linked to some theory of progress, inevitable progress. I don't think anybody here agrees with inevitable progress, because history shows otherwise, doesn't it? Zigzags, yeah, look at Stalin, how that society zigzagged from, you know, Tsarism through Stalinism back again to something else. But so, you know, I think we do need to keep in mind that you can negate capitalism, you can change. Change can negate capitalism. I mean, if you look at, say, somebody earlier mentioned, you know, imperialism, Roman imperialism. I mean, perhaps this might be an issue for further discussions, you know, and people have to decide what they want to discuss in the future meetings. Imperialism is probably one of them. But, you know, Roman imperialism was based on slavery, and it's different from modern imperialism. Again, so there's been a lot of change, and, you know, but sometimes change is not always positive, is it? There's the dark side of it. And you were talking about, was it worth it? You know, capitalism in establishing itself. You talked about Africa and slavery. You know, so some parts of capitalism have moved forward and advanced humanity, if you like, but some aspects haven't. Now, you look at the world today, and it, obviously capitalism hasn't been a good thing for a lot of people, for millions of people, probably the majority of mankind, humankind. You know, probably the majority of humankind, it hasn't been much in advance. So, but, you know, it's important not to get too fixated on progress. And I think we're all about changing things, you know, believing that people can change things by our own actions. Like we were talking about earlier, say if you look at, the history of workers' movements, there's many examples of solidarity where something has happened to one group of workers and another group of workers, even though it's not affected them, have come out with them in solidarity. So, you know, that is an element of the new society, or it would be certainly solidarity, and that human bonds would be non-capitalist. And you can see that, you know, in society. So, I'll leave it there. Yeah, David.
Yeah, I suppose as well as the sort of question of progress in terms of generating, you know, more and more abundance and that kind of idea that capitalism is creating the basis for communism, I think is wrong, because I think you could never say, oh, in 1871 or 1917 there couldn't have been a successful communist revolution just because there wasn't enough stuff. But there's also an idea of progress in terms of, well, for example, like the idea that like the end of history idea is, you know, the inevitable rise of like liberal democracy and democratic rights. And, you know, like Hegel talks about, you know, the spirit of freedom, and like, you know, history is freedom winning. I suppose in a way, in a very partial and contradictory way, it's true that over the grand sweep of history, like, we enjoy more personal rights and more freedom to do what we want, and also freedom to organise and so on. But, you know, often say like anti-racist or anti-sexist struggles or struggles for more democratic rights are often co-opted or, you know, integrated into capitalism rather than representing an alternative to it. So, yeah, I mean, I think obviously there's no inevitable march of progress, and capitalist progress often includes very reactionary things. I think though, I mean, so for example, in China though, so, you know, obviously in a sense the massive economic development in China is in a very contradictory and limited way beneficial to sections of the population, not just the bureaucracy. So, but that I don't mean we should all say, oh, support China, isn't it great what's going on in China? Not at all. But your critique wouldn't just be one of sort of, you know, defend the existing austerity. You know, it's a lot of the problem is how they're doing what they are rather than the fact that they're doing it at all, kind of just in terms of like building infrastructure and so on. So I want to say something about the, yeah, because Barry and Chris touched on earlier, the question of kind of glorifying Marx. I think it's quite right to be critical. A real problem is, certainly as I feel as someone who used to be a Trotskyist, is that often you reread Marx and you find it says something different from what his supposed disciples today say it does.
Like the Bible.
Indeed. And, you know, but a problem is kind of when you sort of defend what he says against people who try and use it as the Bible, as Holy Writ, how do you say that they're wrong in how they interpret it without just sounding like you're defending your claim to the orthodoxy? You know, like keeping Marx to yourself and not letting them have him. I mean, certainly something which is very noticeable in both Marx texts and also the Castoria Edison, and also the worst of all in William Morris, is that they're very sexist. Like in the Morris book, near the start, there's a thing where he first goes into London and he asks someone to hold his horse for him, and he says to the other guy, "Oh, what a pretty creature." And he says, "Oh yes, it's a mule or something." And he's like, "No, I meant the girl." And they'll go, "Ha ha ha." And it's terribly sexist. Obviously we don't want to just say this is really great, because, nor is it fair enough to say, "Oh well, you know, they're men of their time," because all the other stuff they talked about was well ahead of its time. There's no excuse for those kind of attitudes, which come through quite strongly now.
Any more?
I was only going to say that I don't necessarily think that communism is inevitable, but on an earlier point, I think someone said that the Russian Revolution and say the Chinese Revolution, for example, couldn't have succeeded because of the material conditions at that time. But so I think someone said that's a wrong analysis to take, whereas I don't think it is necessarily, because for communism to be able to succeed anyway, mandatory labour has to be abolished, and the only way you can do that is through technological advance, and it's only recently that technology has become so advanced that most of our work is done by machinery, and most of our work will be done by, and if not all of our work will be done by machinery in the future. And so communism couldn't have reached communism in 1917, and personally as well, I don't think that statist socialist solution would have solved anything either, or would have been able to be the transition from capitalism to communism. And so that's why inevitably the Russian Revolution, I see it as a bourgeois revolution, so it would have inevitably reverted back to a more open capitalist society as we see today, although that's sort of detracting from the point that David made earlier on, which
what would you have the machines?
in general, I mean, take factory work for example, like
what would the energy source be?
Well, I would know necessarily. I'm not a great scientist. I'm not even a scientist at all. But I mean, there are plenty of there's plenty of resources that we can utilise now, and that we are utilising now. Even fossil fuels and stuff, for example, can be used. And if not that, then we can use fusion technology, which doesn't cause any harm to the environment.
Well, it doesn't work either.
What, fusion technology?
Oh, you mean existing nuclear reactors?
Yeah.
For fission? Okay, sorry, I was getting confused with fission and fusion.
Oh, no, sorry, not the existing ones.
But it isn't. I don't know whether I'm misunderstanding you, but I mean, the point I would make is that technology is not neutral. Because when you look at capitalism, you're looking at a relationship between human beings.
Mm-hmm.
And the way capitalism functions, it doesn't mean that technology will make life easier for us or replace hard labour. In fact, quite the opposite in some cases.
Yeah.
The development of technology means more intense exploitation. For example, the Taylor system or various systems of productivity under capitalism. So you can get technological advance. It won't ease the burden of the worker, but actually increase it. Or if you take technology and alienation, you know, many technologies have led to de-skilling of the workforce, and again a different way to control the workers and intensify their work. So, you know, when you look at it in that way, no level of technology is going to liberate us.
Not under capitalism, is what I'd argue, is because of the parasitic nature of capitalism itself.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, that's probably part of the reason why I suspect that you require technology. Well, not in the sense that I'd actually advocate harming the working class. I'm a member of the working class. I wouldn't want myself to be harmed, like from my own material conditions. But the fact that, because technology is replacing a lot of aspects, it's replacing so many aspects of our own lives at the moment.
Yeah, but how do you harness? Well, in your view, how do you harness technology for human liberation? I mean, how do you do it?
Well, that would have to be in a post-communist society. That would be under workers' control. Workers can't harness technology under capitalist society, just as workers can't harness anything under capitalist society, really.
What would the workers be controlling? I mean, I can understand workers' control under a capitalist enterprise, because the workers would be controlling the capitalists. But, I mean, what would the workers be controlling?
Well, I mean, it's production, I guess. Distribution and services. I don't really know what you're trying to say. Not to be offensive.
No, that's all right.
I'm a bit pissed.
It's okay. It's all right. I don't know. It's just that I don't know if somebody else wants to come in about the limitations of talking about control.
I think comment straightforwardly means that workers run or organise production themselves. So, Barry, if I understand what you're saying, you're drawing a distinction between workers' control and workers' management in the sense that.
Mm.
For example, you might say that in a workplace where the workforce is able to veto management's attacks by walking out, that they have an element of control in that they can control the capitalists by stopping them doing stuff as opposed to running it themselves. But
I wasn't saying that workers in under capitalist society can harness technology by itself, because the only way workers can harness technology in order to liberate themselves is only in a communist society, is only after a revolution. I was only saying, my point was that technology is necessary for capitalist society. Well, no, not capitalist society, but technology is, technological advance even is necessary for conditions of a revolution, for necessary conditions of a revolution. Workers don't tend to rise up until they are themselves at risk. We're seeing the economic crisis at the moment, and it's only until now where workers are again being a lot more militant and stuff, and it is only in times of capitalist crisis that workers do tend to do this. And like you said, you made a point earlier on about the modernisation of the workplace and how that's actually been a negative impact upon workers themselves. Workers are losing their jobs because they're being replaced by machinery, and that's something which workers are recognising and something that they're currently fighting against. They shouldn't be fighting against machinery, but which is why our presence within the workplace is necessary, to be able to say to them, it's not machinery that's the problem, it's capitalist society harnessing machinery to oppress us, but we can harness machinery in order to liberate ourselves.
But I mean, if you're saying that, for example, I understood what you're saying. If you're saying you need a deep economic crisis or a slump for workers to be stirred into revolutionary action, that's not always the case. There has been historically, slumps. And the problem with that approach, many of the Trotskyist groups have that approach, where it's going to come out of a dire economic collapse. Now, you don't need ideas, you don't need a reason to act. Things are so bad that you're going to vote for the Trotskyist leadership when they come along. So you don't need ideas of an alternative society. You don't need a vision of an alternative society. You just say you're praying for the slump to get deeper, so that people will be hurt by the economic crisis, and then they'll move into action. I was thinking about, as you were speaking, 1968 in France, where, and I'm bringing in history, obviously, I'm not going to apologise for that, but I'm bringing in history. 1968, where you had conditions of economic boom and where you had one of the greatest general strikes in history and a revolutionary threat to French capitalism. And I think it's only, you know, it was only the Russian Stalinists who rescued the upper class in France in that period. And again, there's, you know, 69 in Italy. Again, you didn't have a slump there in Italy. You didn't have a slump in France in 68 either. But you still had, you know, I think in France one of the slogans was anything is possible. And again, that's talking about looking at alternatives to capitalism rather than just waiting for some inevitable economic collapse or an economic slump. It can go either way, I think, with a slump, can't it?
Mm.
Or a depression,
yeah,
or an economic depression. Sometimes it's provoked militancy and a challenge to capitalism. Sometimes it hasn't.
I mean,
anybody else?
I mean, your faith in technology and machinery, I think, is slightly misplaced. It's not neutral. And you do need to answer, you know, where the energy is going to come from. Nuclear. If the mess that's been created through the nuclear power industry is properly cleaned up, then the balance sheet for nuclear power might well be that it's been a fossil fuel energy sink and it has not been an energy source at all. It will probably, at the end of the day, if it's all cleaned up, I suspect it will never be properly cleaned up. But if it was properly cleaned up, it would probably have taken more fossil fuel energy to produce that nuclear electricity than the than the electricity you've got. So, you know, it doesn't appear to be an energy source. Mm. You know, all the energy at the moment is still coming from fossil fuels. It looks like we're probably past peak oil. It looks like the biggest annual production in any one year was 2005.
We can produce artificial oil already.
Algae. Yeah, but if you look at the areas that have been calculated for the production of algae oil, so how do you propose producing oil?
I can't remember this now, but I remember reading quite a while back now, like they were using specific bacteria to actually reproduce
artificial petroleum. Yeah, it's basically using algae to... But I mean, the areas that are needed, you're like, you know, talking about giving over whole continents to algae production. It's just not viable. It really isn't. I think David Strawn did some calculations on areas needed for algae production, and it's not viable. None of the alternatives produce anywhere near amount as much the quantity of energy as we're getting from fossil fuels. There are no alternatives. And obviously, we've got to stop using the fossil fuels anyway because of the climate consequences, plus the absolutely dire ecological consequences of the latest generations of fossil fuels, like the oil sands, oil shales, you know, unbelievable environmental destruction in Canada.
But what would you propose then as an alternative energy source?
I think we have to use renewables,
such as just like solar power and. Because the thing is, like, fusion doesn't produce waste.
It does
require a lot of energy.
There's another big problem with all the nuclear stuff, is that it's all based on very large power plants that all run in a hierarchical manner. They all depend on hierarchical power structures, and I don't agree with hierarchical power structures.
But
so it's not. It cannot be a decentralized. You cannot have decentralized power production from nuclear power plants.
Oh, right, okay.
So
I'm just interested, like, why is that the case?
Well, because they're big, they're fucking massive. You know, you need a lot of people to run, you know, they are... And that is why the government favours them so much, because they are a good match for a hierarchical society, because it appears to be a hierarchical form of energy production.
Yeah, go on.
just two comments. Just because something's big doesn't mean... I'm not a fan of nuclear power, right? But just because something's big doesn't mean it has to be run hierarchically, necessarily. Like, I mean, you have 1936, CNT managed hundreds of factories. That's huge infrastructure. But, you know, that was recallable delegates. basically decision making was still on a horizontal basis at the grassroots, but you know, you built up from the lowest level upwards. So then, you know, it was big, but decision making was still contained on the ground. But saying that, I don't think nuclear power is a decent option. I am slightly sceptical of some of the kind of projections that environmentalists make about kind of energy production, because as I kind of mentioned previously, they're mostly based on the needs and requirements of an economy as it exists now.
Sure.
And I don't think, for example, just thinking back to kind of being a climate camp in London and kind of the sheer futility of kind of having bicycle powered energy production and wind powers, and we're looking up and there's Canary Wharf all lit up, you know, like a candle all night long, you know, and I think, you know, reassessing those would change the energy requirements of, you know, the massive amount of waste that, I mean, my partner's is involved in ecological architecture, and just the way the buildings are built is not even considerate of how the energy that they're going to expend. And I think taking those kind of questions on board, there is perhaps a way of generating energy that doesn't have to involve mass decentralisation of energy sources or mass centralisation of energy sources. I think there is a possible middle ground. And I think that in itself does kind of change the possibilities that's in front of you in terms of whether you can or cannot have a certain type of society. Future.